Welcome to the Science Podcast for September 2nd, 2011. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. This week, a special show all about synthetic biology, from clinical applications and do-it-yourself biology to regulatory policies.
Plus, our usual wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The emerging field of synthetic biology brings together biologists, physicists, chemists, and engineers to program new functions and behaviors into cells and living systems. As basic science, it's still on the exotic side, but some researchers see it as a potential game changer in the future, especially in the clinic. In this week's Science, Warren Reuter, Ting Liu, and James Collins review synthetic bio's potential in a variety of clinical applications, including treatment of infectious diseases, vaccine development, and regenerative medicine. Senior author James Collins spoke with me about the story.
Synthetic biology is a relatively new field that's bringing together engineers and biologists to re-engineer organisms. Most of the field is focused on engineering biomolecules and gene circuits with the goal of using these engineered components to reprogram organisms for a variety of new and different functions.
Well, you discuss in your review article in particular how this synthetic biology approach is starting to make its presence felt in the clinic. This is, as you point out, a relatively new field. How far along is this in getting into clinical settings?
So the field is only about a decade old, and the first few years were focused on building toy systems, small synthetic circuits that were primarily motivated by electrical engineering. A couple years past that, the field turned its attention towards a whole different application space, which was bioenergy, and that is programming organisms to convert biomass into different biofuels. What we've now seen in the last few years is the emergence of some very important and cool applications that are directed towards clinical applications and specifically therapeutic interventions.
Well, let's talk about some of those applications. One thing that we hear a lot of talk about these days is antibiotic resistance, about the concern that we're losing our effectiveness against microbial infections. What's the synthetic biology approach to that kind of problem?
So you're correct in that we're facing, I think, a worldwide crisis in that the number of resistant bacterial strains is growing, whilst our antibiotic arsenal is diminishing. And synthetic biology is, as a community now, stepping up and taking on this challenge and developing a number of new platforms that I think will impact this problem quite directly. One area that I think is quite promising is using synthetic biology tools to engineer bacteriophage. Bacteriophage are viruses that specifically and only infect bacteria. And synthetic biologists, including effort in my lab as well as that of Tim Liu at MIT, have engineered bacteriophage, for example, to serve as adjuvants or potentiators for antibiotics.
Well, are these de novo bacteriophages, or are they adaptations of existing organisms, or how does that work?
So what typically happens is that you'll take native bacteriophage and modify them with either engineered proteins or control circuits so as you can change the way they'll function in the bacterium to, for example, express a protein that would enhance the killing efficacy of existing antibiotics.
Hmm.
In another case, efforts have been made to use bacteriophage to break up biofilms. So biofilms are communities of bacteria that are encapsulated in an extracellular polysaccharide matrix and attached to a surface. And it turns out that biofilms underlie chronic and recurrent infections. And bacteria in biofilms are highly problematic. They're about 1,000 times more resistant than planktonic bacteria. And synthetic biologists have engineered bacteriophage to express enzymes to break up the biofilm so as to then remediate the chronic and recurrent infection.
Well, what are some other areas that, in the areas of specific diseases and conditions, that synthetic biology is finding a use in?
So probably one of the more exciting areas is in cancer therapy. There is some early but promising methods and techniques coming out of synthetic biology where, for example, multiple groups are now looking to engineer bacteria to seek out tumors and then to express invasin, a protein that will allow the bacteria to enter the tumor and then either express proteins that are toxic to the tumor and or to express antisense molecules that will shut off regulatory networks or pathways that are underlying the development of the tumor.
One thing I was really interested in your review was kind of the larger scale interventions that you describe with respect to synthetic biology. For example, re-engineering a patient's entire sort of microbiome, the sort of entire complement of microorganisms in a given patient to fight a specific infection or condition, and this whole notion that you also mentioned of cell therapy. Could you take us through some of those applications?
Sure. I think these are probably the two areas with the most promise and most excitement. Firstly, on the human microbiome, as we're beginning to appreciate, there are 10 to 100 times more bacterial cells in our bodies than there are mammalian cells. And we're beginning to appreciate the role that these bacterial cells play in both our healthy states but also disease states. And synthetic biologists are now approaching this from two perspectives. One, there are efforts underway to engineer bacteria to express proteins that are lacking in certain conditions, be it either an allergy or an inflammatory condition. And in other states, there's now this whole movement towards synthetic ecology, where groups are now exploring, can you actually engineer community of different bacteria that can be introduced into a patient to try to restore their microbiome to the healthy state?
Well, are there any particular examples where that's been tried in a clinical setting, or is this still kind of on the drawing board?
I think it's still very much in the drawing board and early stages, and I think the field is still really trying to work out how does one actually design that community so that you have the proper percentages of the good bacteria versus the potentially harmful bacteria.
And how about cell therapy?
So in cell therapy, what we've seen over the last few years is great enthusiasm for induced pluripotent stem cells. That is where you can take an adult cell and transform it into a stem cell-like state and use that for regenerative medicine. What synthetic biologists have done in just this last year is actually introduce a technique where synthetic RNA molecules were used to create the induced pluripotent stem cells. And this approach turned out to be about 10 times more efficient than the traditional approaches and much safer without needing to use viral vectors. I think what we're going to see in this space in the next few years is the use of synthetic biology approaches for in vivo reprogramming and differentiation of cells at the site of injury or disease.
So, you know, I mean, looking at this and some other synthetic biology applications you discuss in your review, if I'm understanding it all correctly, we've taken some initial steps, but it does sound like there's quite a ways to go before we start seeing this as part of the standard clinical arsenal. How long do you think that might take?
It's a great question. I think it's difficult to make predictions, particularly of the future, in terms of clinical studies. And I think that's very true in this case. As you note, I think we're in the very early stages of this field, in particular this application space, where most of the focus is still on developing the techniques and getting at early proof of principle. I think we're probably still a few years away from seeing a synthetic biology technique that's actually approved, but I don't think we're more than a year or two away from seeing early clinical trials. I think this field in general will benefit greatly as the clinical community becomes more aware of what these teams of engineers and molecular biologists are doing in the lab and embrace them and see how they can actually be utilized to address what are clearly some very important clinical problems.
One very interesting thing about this field is how incredibly interdisciplinary it is. I mean, you've got engineers, you've got computer science involved, you've got, you know, microbiologists, but also, you know, looking at clinical applications, you have sort of this whole translational medicine aspect. How do those cultures work together?
I think you bring up a very interesting point that speaks to one of the challenges, but also one of the real opportunities here. And the challenge is that it's always difficult for two very different groups to get together and make advances. But what I find that's very encouraging, particularly about the clinical and biological applications of synthetic biology, is that the clinicians and the molecular biologists appreciate how complicated and complex either their conditions, diseases, or systems of interest are, and they recognize that the engineers are trained quite well in complexity, and they've been incredibly open and embracing to these engineering principles and perspectives that some of the early pioneers in synthetic biology bring. What I think we're seeing is that, you know, the smart amateurs are able to make some pretty good progress in the initial points. I think the field will benefit tremendously as young people are trained and brought up in this interdisciplinary discipline so that to them, it's actually old hat.
Jim Collins, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
James Collins is a co-author of a new review on synthetic biology and its potential for use in the clinic. It's part of a special section on synthetic biology in this week's Science.
In a news story this week, Sam Keen introduces us to a small community facility in Brooklyn, New York, that boasts a full stock of equipment for, say, growing your own mushrooms and worms. But we're not talking about a community garden. This is GenSpace, an independent scientific laboratory set up to encourage curious biologists, engineers, and artists to design and carry out their own experiments in what is now being called the do-it-yourself biology movement. He spoke with me about the story after a visit to the laboratory.
The basic idea was that there were amateur scientists and also some professional scientists who wanted sort of a more informal place to do biology. They wanted a chance almost to play at doing biology. And for a while, actually, they were doing it in one person's living room in New York, but they decided that it made more sense to get a formal lab space. And so they decided to open this place in New York, GenSpace. And the story also discusses that this is actually kind of a bigger, broader movement. There's a lot of people out there who want to do-it-yourself biology nowadays.
Can you talk a little bit more about do-it-yourself biology? What are some of the examples of the projects that are being done in this lab?
Most of the projects are pretty simple things right now, but they have sort of a fun or unusual edge to them. There's a couple people who are in GenSpace right now working on microorganisms that would glow in the dark or turn different colors. One person wants to do it with a little worm, C. elegans. Another person wants to do it with plants to make glowing plants. There's also some people who have a little more practical bent, something that might be a little more entrepreneurial. Someone's working on this fungus that could possibly be used as insulation or as packing material. And he's also working on a microorganism that would change colors when you detect arsenic. So you could use it, say, to test for arsenic in the groundwater. Another focus of the lab, this isn't quite do-it-yourself, but it's a focus of the lab, is just to educate people about biology. So they bring a lot of people in from the streets who have decided they want to learn a little bit more. They pay about $300 for a four-week class, and they do things like splice some DNA, or maybe they look at their own DNA, things like that.
And so this lab is not affiliated with, you know, other organizations or academic institutions. And so are these classes the primary way in which this lab is funded?
That's how they've made most of their revenue so far. There are 12 members right now in GenSpace, and each one contributes about $100 a month for lab fees, basically their membership fees, $100 a month. But of course, that's not a whole lot when you're trying to run even a small-scale biological laboratory. So the fees that they've collected from the classes so far have been a big boon to them.
Yeah, and I can imagine, I mean, the idea of starting my own lab is just absolutely overwhelming. I can imagine there must have been a lot of roadblocks that they encountered in addition to just finding the funds.
Yeah, getting the equipment was one of the obstacles. But they actually said, they told me that it wasn't that hard to find equipment nowadays. They said, unfortunately, there's a fair number of biotech companies that are either suffering or going out of business that want to unload or donate some of their equipment. One member actually bought an incubator off of eBay. You can find a fair amount of pretty good equipment there nowadays.
Hmm.
And they also saved a little bit on the building itself. It was quite an unusual place. It's primarily an artist collective, where designers, artists, mini cupcake makers, all sorts of people work inside this building. Their lab benches were recycled countertops from restaurants, and the roof of the building, they wanted to put possibly a sauna up there. They were talking about getting chicken coops up there. So it's really a lot of people with some strange and unusual ideas. So they got the lab space actually pretty cheap, and that was one of the reasons they were able to open it.
And it also sounds like there are even some artists that are working within this lab itself as well?
Yeah, there are. There's at least a couple artists that I can think of. One that I talked to was very excited to do a project about invasive species. She'd been trying to grow some mushrooms and some other things at her home, but like most homes, it just wasn't quite antiseptic enough, and she didn't have quite the right equipment to keep them alive. And so she was very happy that GenSpace was open to letting artists come in and just basically work on what they wanted to. So it really is a mix of people who some just want to tinker or do fun things, some are a little entrepreneurial, and some actually came in there because they thought they could make cool art with it.
Now, what about, I mean, one thing I think about is safety regulations and inspections. How do they ensure that the workspace is safe and non-hazardous?
Well, they are biosafety level one. That's the type of work they're doing, which means that they're basically working with non-infectious organisms. So you wouldn't be working on anything that could infect humans. When they're working with E. coli, for instance, the very safe strain of E. coli, not something that's going to be dangerous to people. And actually, they told me they had rejected a proposal that involved some pathogens that contribute to human acne. So even something like acne, they decided they really didn't want to get into too much. Some other things they've been doing is they have a board and they have a government safety officer and a university safety officer on their board advising them. And another thing they did that I think was smart is they've been in constant contact with the FBI. The FBI has actually raided a few places in the past trying to root out bioterrorism, and they decided it was going to be smarter just to sort of make friends with the FBI up front and to, again, stay in contact with them, just let them know what's going on. So they really were trying to make sure law enforcement knew what they were doing and that it was pretty innocuous stuff. No crazy mad scientist, dangerous things going on.
What about intellectual property?
That was one thing that came up that surprised me a little bit. GenSpace decided that they were going to give whoever created something in the lab the intellectual property rights, so he or she can do whatever he or she wanted with the things they make. That was actually more controversial, apparently, than I expected, partly because the do-it-yourself biology movement really grew partly out of computer culture, sort of the hacker movement. They sometimes call themselves biohackers, and they look at biology, life, as something that you can program and reprogram. And a lot of the computer people, it sounds like, were kind of horrified at the idea that someone would be able to retain intellectual property rights. But the people at GenSpace argued that, you know, computer code and something biological are really two different beasts, so to speak, that something biological, it takes a lot more work and effort to create it and to make sure that it works properly, and that, you know, putting the same financial constraints on it as you would with software just might not work in the long run.
So what do you see as the future for this kind of facility? Do you think this is something that's going to catch on like wildfire for these rogue scientists out there? Or is it kind of going to, you know, this one's going to shut down and that'll be the end of the experiment?
I think it's definitely going to expand. There's actually another lab that I talk about in the story a little bit called BioCurious. They're based in the Bay Area in California. They actually opened a lab very recently, too, or maybe they're getting ready to open it, but they're in the process of opening a lab. And there are other places around the country that are gathering people and starting to work on these kind of things. And in the long run, I wouldn't be surprised if it does sort of parallel the computer culture. Computers were, for a long time, they were the province of this sort of geeky subculture. And then they exploded into everyday life. It's probably impossible to make a prediction about when that might happen or the changes that might happen. But I really wouldn't be surprised if sort of these kind of biological things entered mainstream culture. But again, the other factor to consider is that software you can program something and, you know, it can work or not work, but you can figure out pretty easily on your computer if it's going to work. Biology is more complex, so I guess it's an open question of whether things will succeed as smoothly as they did with computers.
Sam Keen, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sam Keen writes about the do-it-yourself biology movement in a news article this week.
Synthetic biology isn't all fun and games. The emergence of this new area is also stoking public concerns about its potential misuse, ranging from the creation of new bioweapons to possible ethical issues. In a policy forum in this week's Science Special Issue, Reena Singh of the Biotechnology Industry Organization, along with two colleagues, presents the biotech industry's perspective on the best approach to regulating this still-emerging area. She points out that the tools that provide a basis for synthetic biology, such as those of genetic engineering, have actually been in use for decades, and that synthetic biology can be seen as a natural evolution of those tools.
So despite the hype and the science fiction discussion, synthetic biology is an extension of genetic engineering tools that have been safely used in the commercial development of therapies, therapeutics, agriculture, and industrial applications, for the past 40 years. And it's based on very well-known technology in not only academia, but in the industry, recombinant DNA. So there are several examples of its uses, products that are under development, also marketed today, commercially available. So synthetic biology in its current application does not pose significant novel threats that are any different from those posed by biotechnology industry sector itself. And so when it's all said and done, regulatory frameworks should recognize this and support innovation and commercial development of new products from synthetic biology.
One of the things that struck me is you mentioned the tendency of some reporters, and I guess even some in the field, to apply engineering or sort of computing metaphors to synthetic biology. What are some of those metaphors, and why do you think they might be a bit problematic?
So while these metaphors can help people understand the science, in some instances, they're good to use, but it's a reference to a more familiar technology. It can basically mislead perceptions of how synthetic biology might need to be regulated and develop policies. So basically, living organisms are very different and very complex than electronic systems. And even with the gains in our understanding of genomics and genetic engineering, it is more difficult and less predictable than computer science. So intellectual property law, policy, and research and development in the life sciences cannot be modeled after law and policy in electronics. So at the end of the day, these are two different sciences.
And you mentioned sort of early on that as the biotech industry sees it, synthetic biology is really an extension of technologies that have come before. But there does seem to be this kind of widespread sense that synthetic biology is somehow different. Could you put that in context, sort of talking about what synthetic biology really means to the biotech industry? What, if you will, what sort of metaphors are appropriate?
So it's always very hard to have descriptors or labels with science, but in this instance, synthetic biology is definitely vital to the continued evolution of the biotechnology industry, to the speed and efficiency in genetic engineering techniques and the growing catalog of information about the genomes of various living systems more or less required new ways of thinking about how to apply this knowledge to practical solutions to healthcare, agriculture, and industrial challenges. The biotechnology industry, instead of looking for natural living systems that can be optimized with minimal changes to meet a need, can now envision massive parallel changes to the structure of known systems to achieve the same goals. But it still starts from the point of taking a natural resource and breeding it to meet human needs, and which is in the long tradition of animal husbandry.
So in some sense, we're talking about gains in efficiency and speed and cost effectiveness, but pressed into service for the kinds of goals that sort of have a long pedigree in biotechnology. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yes, definitely. So the speed and the efficiency, which lead to the efficacy of a given process, and the cost effectiveness of the tool sets that synthetic biology brings, also the precision. But the difference is in the potential that increased speed, efficiency, and precision hold for bringing real-world applications to success in consumer products. For example, cephalexin, which is a synthetic antibiotic. It's commercial. It's processed. It traditionally was 13 chemical steps that were reduced to 2 enzymatic chemical steps using synthetic biology, which increases the speed to production, increases speed to market, and it also lowers the number of steps, which at the end, when it's all said and done, it reduces the cost of the product. So you and I would be paying less for something such as an important antibiotic.
And so that's one example, and you cite some others in your paper, where synthetic biology has led to the development of new products in a very cost-effective way. But, I mean, I think that what people tend to dwell on, I guess, is this so-called dual-use nature of synthetic biology. People tend to gravitate toward the potential for bioweapons development, for example, or for some sort of unintended negative consequences. And that, I think, gets to the issue of governance, which you also cover in your paper. From the perspective of the biotech industry, what is the right regulatory approach here in light of this progress in synthetic biology?
Very good question. So, in the Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues, the study mentions historically biotechnology has been regulated using a coordinated framework. This means that a separate new regulatory agency that will regulate synthetic biology is not required. Instead, it should be regulated through the activities of existing government agencies such as the NIH, CDC, FDA, USDA, OSHA, DOT, DOC, DOE, and EPA. And also, it should follow the same science-based voluntary guidelines that are in existence today. And so the bioethics report discusses regulatory parsimony, which is defined as having only as much oversight as is truly necessary to ensure justice, fairness, security, and safety while pursuing the public good. So therefore, announcements of misguided or conflicting regulations would stifle the growth of the industry and would reduce the probability that society would benefit from what synthetic biology can provide.
So from your perspective in the biotech industry, the sort of hazards, in a sense, of over-regulating synthetic biology at this point in its evolution kind of outweigh the benefits of extra regulation.
That is correct.
I guess one thing that struck me, you know, when I was reading your policy forum, which hadn't really hit me before, is the extent to which it seems that synthetic biology, by kind of making the tool sets more efficient and more cost-effective, might in some sense be said to be lowering the barriers to entry to biotechnology work, to this kind of work. And there's even a story in this issue of Science about quote-unquote DIY biology and community labs. Is there a point at which the barriers to entry become so low that some sort of more active government oversight is inevitable?
Yeah, and so that's a pretty broad question, and I think I'd probably take an hour to really answer that, but let me try here. So in the United States, synthetic biology is practiced by organizations that are not for profit and also for profit, and as you mentioned, do-it-yourself biologists. So among these groups, those receiving federal funding are required to follow the NIH guidelines for recombinant DNA research. So what will most useful to all involved would be that the President's Bioethics Commission pretty much correctly points out that increased knowledge amongst regulators and users, such as the DIU community, about the technology, known risks, and codes of ethical conduct. So awareness and being able to educate and inform the end users is very important.
Reena Singh, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Reena Singh provides a biotech industry perspective on regulating synthetic biology technologies in a policy forum in this week's Science.
Finally today, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with some of the latest stories from our daily news site. So this week, we've got a lot of material on chemical interactions within our bodies. Where would you like to start, David?
Well, let's start first about a chemical interaction, or at least a chemical that used to be pretty good and is still pretty good for us, something known as an antibiotic. And as you know, Carrie, antibiotics have been around for a while. They're considered wonder drugs because they've helped us battle a lot of maladies that used to really wipe people out. But the problem with these wonder drugs is they tend to induce what's called antibiotic resistance, which basically means that if you use too much of these drugs, the bacteria or other organisms start to get resistant, and then the drugs no longer fight them anymore. And we're actually reaching a point where we're starting to run out of effective antibiotics. Scientists are even talking about a post-antibiotic age, which does not sound very promising. The question is, the new study is, how long has antibiotic resistance been around? And the surprising answer seems to be that it's actually been around for tens of thousands of years, much longer than human beings have been using antibiotics.
So how do they determine that? How can they go back 10,000 years in time?
Well, it's a great question. So basically what they did was they drilled what's called sediment cores. And the place they looked in this study was in a region called Dawson City, which is in Canada's Yukon Territory. So they drill these cores, and if they drill far enough, they can actually get to a layer that they can date to about 30,000 years ago. And when they got to this layer, they were able to extract some DNA, which came from bacteria. And the really interesting thing about this DNA is they found fragments of genes in there that are very similar to genes in bacteria today that confer resistance against various antibiotics. Antibiotics like penicillin, tetracycline, and vancomycin. In fact, when the researchers reconstructed some of this DNA, they found a vancomycin resistance gene that was very similar to a vancomycin resistance gene that bacteria use today to battle this antibiotic.
How could they guarantee that there was no contamination from modern bacteria?
Well, that's a great question, because you're always worried about that. And actually, the interesting thing they did is they actually sprayed their equipment with fluorescent E. coli cells, and E. coli are also a bacteria. And that way they knew that if any of this outside material leaked into the core sample, the E. coli would also leak in there and they would see fluorescence. And so they knew when they didn't see fluorescence, they were dealing with a very pure sample.
So you said that they were able to find evidence of antibiotic resistance in these older bacteria. But without synthetic antibiotics, what would have driven the development of this resistance?
Well, it turns out that the antibiotics that we use today, we actually are sort of stealing from bacteria and fungi themselves. Bacteria fight other bacteria, fungus fight bacteria, and vice versa. And when they do this, they utilize antibiotics, the antibiotics that they make. And we, over time, have found ways to adopt these antibiotics and use it in human beings. But these battles between bacteria and fungi have been going on for thousands, millions, even perhaps billions of years. So it makes sense that antibiotic resistance would have developed a long time ago, much earlier than when we started developing our own antibiotics.
And now for our next story, we have an interaction between the gut and the brain.
Right. And this is another bacteria story. This isn't about bacteria using antibiotics, or at least evolving resistance to antibiotics. This story is about bacteria that could potentially alter your mental state. The headline we use is actually mind-altering bugs, a little play on mind-altering drugs there. But basically, the idea is, can the bacteria that live in our bodies, and there are millions, billions, maybe even more bacteria that live on our skin, that live in our body, that live in our digestive tract. And they actually are sort of part of a mini ecosystem that we harbor. And researchers knew that the bacteria in our guts actually play a role in our body. They can influence our physiology, our health, our weight even, sometimes perhaps even our immunity. And the question in this study is, do these bacteria that live in our gut, might they also have an effect on our brain?
So how was this study framed?
Well, what they did was they tested this in mice, as is often the case, and they fed these mice a broth containing a benign bacterium that's known as Lactobacillus rhamnosus. And this is a bacteria that's actually present in a lot of prebiotic supplements. So these are bacteria that you and I, or other people, ingest on a fairly regular basis. And almost right away, they noticed some very interesting changes in these mice. They became much less stressed out. They became much less anxious. They just seemed to have a much calmer mental state than the control mice that didn't get these bacteria.
How do scientists measure the calmness, the anxiety of mice?
Well, that's a great question. And the way they do it is they actually put mice on these narrow, elevated walkways. And they also put them in wide open spaces. And this really stresses mice out. Mice don't like to be out in the open because they're worried about predators. Obviously, they don't like to be in a high walkway because they're afraid they're going to fall. And most rodents react very nervously to this. They exhibit big spikes in stress hormones. But the mice that ate a lot of these lactobacillus bacteria were actually pretty calm. Even when the researchers put them in water, which really stresses mice out, they didn't really get that stressed out.
And why do scientists think this is?
Well, so researchers are trying to figure out why just having different bacteria in your system, why would that change your sort of mental state? And so they did some more studies, and what they found was that the mice that were fed these bacteria had changes in the activity of genes that encode portions of a receptor for the neurotransmitter GABA. And GABA is involved in a lot of neural activity. It seems to play a role in anxiety and other anxiety-related disorders. And the researchers aren't sure exactly what's going on, but they think that somehow having these bacteria in the gut somehow influences the activity of GABA, or at least the efficacy of GABA, sometimes positively, sometimes negatively, but the net effect is that these mice end up being a lot less stressed out.
We already have antidepressants and all sorts of hormone and mood-altering drugs. So what's different about these?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, if this actually works in humans, which is a big if at this point, in fact, one of the experts says, you know, we're so different from mice, there's no way this actually is going to hold true in humans. But we actually do have a lot in common with mice. So, but if this actually does hold true, then you could imagine perhaps a dietary supplement might be enough to change somebody's mood. You wouldn't have to go on those heavy-duty drugs you just mentioned. Maybe just eating a particular type of yogurt or something else supplemented with probiotics could make all the difference. Of course, this is very speculative at this point. They've only done the research in mice, but it's an interesting avenue for future research.
And our last story today is, again, looking at mice to learn more about the human brain.
Right. Mice are playing a big role in science now this week. This last story, Carrie, is about a potential fountain of youth and also a fountain of aging for the brain. The study is all about why does our brain become more sluggish when we grow older? And this is something we've talked about every once in a while on this podcast. And the question in this study was, are there chemicals in the bloodstream that actually cause the brain to deteriorate over time, or at least impair our mental functioning over time? And it's not really that far out of an idea. Scientists have recently isolated stem cells in the brain, which seem to give rise to new neurons. And the older somebody is, the less the activity of these stem cells, the less new neurons they have. And some people have said, well, that may explain, you know, if their brain's not regenerating itself, that may explain why a lot of people have mental deterioration with age. But none of this has actually been shown. And again, turning to mice, what researchers did was they actually hooked up the circulatory system of a very young mouse to an older mouse. It was about a 3-month-old mouse to a 2-year-old mouse. And what they found was that the older mouse started to grow a lot more new cells in the hippocampus region of its brain, whereas the younger mouse, the production of new cells dropped by almost a quarter. So there was this interesting effect the mice's blood were having on each other. And the researchers said, well, there must be something in the blood that's both promoting growth of brain cells and also hurting growth of brain cells. And so they did a little bit more searching, and what they found was 17 compounds that increased in the bloodstream as a mouse aged. And they think that one of these compounds, which is called CCL11, in normal mice, they think that that is something that slows neurogenesis, which is the growth of new neurons as mice get older. But because of the experiment they carried out in this study, they think there must also be compounds that are acted as almost like a fountain of youth for the brain, because in this case, it seems like there must be compounds in the blood of young mice that had an influence on the brain of older mice and caused them to grow new neurons.
So it sounds like there's a lot of future work to be done, but that it could have tremendous implications for the use in humans.
Exactly. I mean, people always get excited about this, you know, dementia, and we're always worried about, you know, having our minds go as we grow older. And a lot of the therapies are really targeted to the brain itself. And this study suggests that maybe just by targeting the blood, you could have a dramatic impact on the brain.
So what other news stories have we had this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about an atom-sized mirror. It's a mirror as small as an atom. Also a story about an unusual way tropical frogs ingest water. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about a very controversial study that was carried out in Guatemala in the 1940s, where American researchers appear to have infected hundreds of Guatemalans with sexually transmitted diseases in what appears to be a very unethical study, according to a new report. Also an item about the future of research in Antarctica. Also this week, we're announcing the 2011 Dance Your PhD contest. So for any scientists out there that have PhDs, that are interested in interpreting their PhD work in dance form to win a number of fabulous prizes, including $1,000 and a trip to Brussels, be sure to check out the announcement on our website. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat is about coral reefs, the dangers they face, and the possibilities for rescuing them. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that wraps up the September 2nd, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.